What's going on, guys? Ty here, Bench Clear Media. Welcome to a new series that we're kicking off today called The Leap. And it's focused on speaking to people who made that jump from part-time to full-time in the sports card industry. I realize that a lot of us have dreams of that, maybe even nightmares about that. But the reality is people have done it. They've taken that passion. They've tested things out. They've turned this hobby into a full-time job for themselves. And there's all kinds of spectrums within the hobby, from collectors to investors to breakers to starting a tech company in the hobby. And there's a lot of ways to do what you love, sports cards, and support your family or yourself with it. And so I want to help tell those people's stories over the course of the next few episodes. I hope you enjoy it. If you are any type of collector, whether you sell on eBay or you do things on other platforms, you're going to love today's episode with JT from Triple Crown 24. You might know him from YouTube. He has a great YouTube channel, but he also does a ridiculous amount on eBay. He started 2 years ago full-time and has continued to grow his business. Now leases his own office space, has multiple employees, and is consigning and bringing in hundreds of cards a day and selling those through his eBay store, and it is and going to shows and all kinds of other things. We talk about all of that, the tips and tricks of eBay. We talk about the tips and tricks of other platforms, the things that he's learned early on, how to manage kind of the frustrations that can happen with eBay buyers, and really just the systems that you need to make it successful. We talk about PSA versus SGC. We cover a lot of ground in an hour, and I think as any type of hobbyist, you're going to love this discussion. So enjoy episode one of The Leap. Now, two things really quick. We put out this content, guys, and we aren't really monetarily rewarded. It does not move the needle on our channel, I promise. But what does help us and what gets us motivated is being able to get this in front of more people. And the way you can do that is simply by liking, subscribing, maybe checking the notifications button on your YouTube channel there for us. Because when you do that and then you comment, it moves us up the YouTube algorithm so that other people can watch our content. We're putting out these interviews and these conversations and these analytics. We want people to see it. That's why we do it. So if you could do that for us, that'd be super helpful. We really do appreciate you doing that. Second, I do put out content, a lot of content. 99% of my content here, Mike does the same, but we have our own personal channels as well. I put out stuff on Breaker Culture, which is what I got started doing 6 or 7 years ago. I do weekly update videos of the inventory flowing in and out of my store. So if you want to see that type of stuff, how I came to grab certain cards, go over there and check out that channel, subscribe, watch those videos, and you might be able to walk away with some nuggets there as well. So anyway, enjoy this first conversation with JT, episode one of The Leap. See ya.
Having trouble managing your valuable collection and finding price transparency in the sports card market? Me too. That's why I use Card Hedge. Card Hedge is a brilliant price analysis and collection management tool. Track all your grades across PSA, CSG, HGA, SGC, BGC, and as well as your raw cards. Card Hedge pulls their research from sites like eBay, StarStock, MySlabs, and Golden Auctions. You want an accurate picture of the sports card market? Yeah, me too. With over tens of thousands of cards in their system, Card Hedge is the definitive sports card price guide. Quickly search by card, player, or set. Sort by price or percentage change. It has a lot of awesome advanced features. So what are you waiting for? Join today for only $14.99.
JT, what's up, man? How are you?
Living the dream, Ty. How are you?
I had to get up this morning and go get my tractor out for another 4 inches of snow that got dropped on us last night. We're at 9 inches in the last week, and it just keeps coming.
I don't envy you. See, I have a problem where I have like 9-inch stacks of cardboard all around me, but those are easier to move around.
I you should try a tractor for those too. There's some piles I have that I think I would take a tractor to. Nice. Well, man, I'm excited to talk to you. You and I have been going back and forth, and this is part of a new series that we're doing, just focusing on folks that made the leap from kind of part-time hobby to full-time. This is your gig, man. This is, you live and breathe this. So I want to help tell your story, let people kind of walk away with a bunch of tips and lessons learned, and maybe think for themselves and leave with some ideas for starting on their own or deciding not to start on their own. But let's start with this, man. You're a unique collector. I mean, you're a younger guy, obviously, but you're vintage. You have kind of unique traits with the way you collect. Kind of tell people what you collect and kind of how you got into the hobby.
So I feel like everyone has their how I got into the hobby story, like, down, where they have it written out in like this cinematic script. Like mine, I don't even really remember the exact start. I know that when I was really young, I was really into hockey cards, and then I got really into baseball because the 06 Tigers, that team is just so much fun to watch, and it's never really been something I've felt again with watching a Tigers team, just because it was it was magical. Maybe here in the next few years, we'll see. Maybe we can get back to that. But so really, I got into it, and it was just the jack of all trades at that point in time, master of none. And then I started focusing more so on like specific players or specific teams, and I started to get more so into football. I'm a Detroit Lions fan, which is going to make a lot of your listeners cringe probably right off the bat. Anyone else who out there is a Lions fan listening to with me, you know, we're brothers and sisters in solidarity here over some pretty bad players that have come through the hobby. A lot of busts. I mean, let's go through the laundry list. Like Javid Best, I had a Javid Best PC. I had a Mikel LeShore PC, Ryan Broyles, Eric Ebron, Amir Abdullah. We only have so much time here, so I'll stop the list there. We can throw it back to Joey Harrington if we want to. My first football love and heartbreak there. And I just got sick of collecting these guys who never amounted to anything. So then I focused towards, okay, well, let me think more nostalgic. What's something that cannot be taken away from me? And that was Miguel Cabrera's Triple Crown. So that's where the name Triple Crown 24 came from. That's where the super collecting ways, obsessive, compulsive, perhaps to some ways, kind of started. And ever since then, it's been what I've stuck with. And I found it's much easier to manage, you know, what I'm looking for. I don't really get tempted by other things. And being a dealer, if I do get tempted, kind of settles those urges to maybe expand my circle. But I've been doing that for about 3 years now, and I haven't gotten sick of it yet. So
that's interesting. So yes, those are a lot of names that I think I know for sure. I have a lot of past money and those players, but thankfully, right, you do got guys like Barry Sanders and even Matthew Stafford who kind of paid off in the end, or household names for the right reasons. Yeah. So you focus exclusively on Miguel Cabrera, building out that PC. That's interesting, because I do think one of my struggles is always, as you start to hoard cards, right? You gather these cards like, okay, what I want to collect, I want to keep all this stuff now. And you forget that a lot of times, especially when my wife looks at me and says, hey, you need to sell this stuff. You better the heck have a focus. How big is your Miguel Cabrera PC right now?
Just over 3,100 unique cards. And then you got your, you know, miscellaneous things. Like I have a lineup card from 2011 that has some bum named Mike Trout sitting on the bench on the card. It's signed by Mike Socia, and Cabrera hit a home run in that game. I have like a team bat that he signed, a regular bat, a couple of baseballs that are signed, a base from his 2,500th career hit game. So you get those little miscellaneous things in there too. But in terms of just cards, 3,100 plus.
Wow. What's the total? Like, what's the max number you can get to? Are we at 6,000, 7,000? Do you know? I mean,
well, I'll say this, and I hope you're sitting down when I say this. It's probably close to 20,000. And the reason for that is there are certain sets. So if you look at, there's the, are you familiar with the Honus bonus cards?
No.
Okay. So this is like, pretend that you could find retail wax. It's like 2018 and you're out there, you're at Walmart and it's pretty cleared out. It's like the day before restock, so there's not much there, and you're desperate to open something, and you see like a repack blaster for $20. You're like, all right, this will satisfy my urge to rip some wax. Well, there's probably four or five packs of these Honus bonus cards, which was this, guess this card game that just, it failed. It's unlicensed. And there's a one-of-one card for each of his home runs and each of his RBI in that. So that's 1,500 cards right there. There's the moments and milestone sets that Topps did that died a very quick death back in back about 10, 15 years ago now, where you have a black, blue, and red parallel for each of those in addition to individual base cards. So that takes up probably another 1,500 off the checklist. So that's 3,000 of your 20,000 right there. But you have all the different parallels, all the different one-of-ones included in there. It just goes to show how much things have changed.
Yeah, I'd say so. Holy grail card from Miguel that you don't have, what would it be?
It's tough. So there's two big ones. I would love to have a dual sign card with Trout, just because during his MVP years, Trout being his first couple of years is really cool. There's also, this is a somewhat of a strange item. So the Triple Crown years in 2012. And one of the super fractors out there is the 2012 Bowman Chrome, which was actually signed by him with the Triple Crown inscription. And it's popped up from two different eBay sellers before. I believe it is currently in someone's collection right now, but you never know, it may surface again. But as soon as I saw that the first time, I knew that one day I'd like to own it. So
if that popped up, is that a tough discussion to have about coming up with the money for that? Or is it, are you married?
No.
Okay. All right. So there's no discussion. It's can you make it work?
Right. It's a discussion with myself. Can I, you know, will I be sick to my stomach for the next 2 weeks knowing that I spent that? But I think one of the things that I try to instill into others when I speak to them is just be proud of what you already have. My collection is not any more or any less without it. I've got some really cool stuff that I'm proud of, and I don't really need to add anything else. It's not going to, you know, if someone thinks I'm less of a Miguel Cabrera collector because I don't have that specific card, then that's on them. I don't know what to tell them at that point.
I hear you. All right. So let's dive into a little bit about the transition from part-time to full-time. Before we do that though, I always like to kind of start with, if someone was to walk up to you and say, hey, you're into sports cards, what's the view? Like, what's the current state of the hobby? What would be your answer today? Current state hobby.
Right. I do get that question a lot when people ask me about it. You know, you get the stories of, oh, my dad used to have all these cards. So that part of it has not changed. You're still going to get those if you mention the hobby to someone. I think if you're talking to someone who knows nothing about it, you're going to tell them that it's a $1 trillion industry at this point, I believe. It's booming, and people are surprised by that. You know, some people think that sports cards maybe don't even exist anymore. Or it's just this relic of the past, but yeah. No, that's not the case. If you're talking to someone who's maybe a bit more casual with the hobby, or someone who's more familiar with it, I would just say the game has changed. There's a lot of new avenues, and there's a lot of uncertainty right now, but there's also a lot of reasons to be excited at the same time.
As a hobbyist, are you excited heading into 2022? You feel good about the hobby? Are you concerned?
I'm excited about it just because – so I hear this a lot, like all the do we have the Prophets of Doom graphic handy? Because I hear a lot of doomsdayers, like actual doomsdayers, not you guys. I don't take that message at all. But people like, oh, they're just overprinting everything, and none of these parallels are going to be worth anything. None of this stuff is going to be worth anything. And, you know, there's some truth to a lot of what is said there, but I feel a lot of times when people make it out that it's usually very black and white thinking, where the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. I don't think that this is as bad as the junk wax era. I don't think that this is, you know, we're going to be seeing all-time lows, and it is this doomsday scenario that we are approaching. I just don't think that it's going to be as easy, and it's going to be a big transition, because if you were to, let's say right around the time that I started doing this, if you were to, you know, take your imaginary dart and throw it at the board and say, this is going to go up, chances are you were going to be right about that. And it was so easy. The system was, I'll say it was broken with, you know, the hobby being something where things just kept going up. And that's just not realistic. It's one of those, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. Well, it was true, but the people who can influence that correct it, and then it's no longer true. So you're going to have to, I think you're going to have to be smarter with it. You're going to have to know your stuff a bit more. I think people are wising up, but the exposure that the hobby got, despite maybe some of the bad things that came to it, more people got exposed to it, and more people got reintroduced or introduced to it. And that's going to help grow the hobby in the long term. Whether or not those people stick around, no, not all of them will stick around, but if they're at least exposed to it, it gives that opportunity, where if they weren't exposed to it, then there's no opportunity for growth.
Yeah. No, that's well said. That's a good summary. All right. So you alluded to it. I think you started full time, right? In 2019, late 2019. Kind of give the story before that. You're part time, you're selling cards, are you buying collections? Kind of what was the foray into the part time side before you dove into full time?
So I had just graduated from college the year before. I graduated with a sport management degree, and I was kind of trying to get my foot in the door with certain places, but a lot of the places basically I had to work as an unpaid intern and sacrifice my entire savings to do so with the hope that I would get a job. And knowing what happened the following year, very likely I would have lost that job and lost everything that I had worked for. So it's almost a good thing that it did not work out. But I had sold cards for many years before that, just kind of casual. If I had opened something out of a box that I didn't want or traded for something, I would sell it. And there's a pretty big show that's actually happening this weekend. Unfortunately, won't be able to make it this year. It's at a place called Moeller High School, which there's a couple of pretty good baseball players that used to play there. I think their names were Barry Larkin and Ken Griffey Jr. Here in the Cincinnati area. And it's a pretty big show here in the Midwest. And a lot of Midwest dealers will know about Moeller. Usually you get a lot of the big red machine guys coming into the new signings. So I actually had received an invitation to go set up there the weekend of Thanksgiving back in 2019. And I said that I didn't have a story for how I got into the hobby, but I do have a story. And this one sounds very cinematic. Like if you ever needed to do an adaptation of my sports card dealing journey, I've already got the script for you for this one, because it was actually in, I remember it very clearly, because the Yankees and Astros were playing in the ALCS in 2019. It was game 6. And I was about to sit down and watch the game, but I saw on Facebook there was this message like, hey, we have a table available at this show up in Jackson, Michigan area, so central Michigan. And I said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and set up, knowing that in about 4 weeks' time I was going to set up at this other show. So I had started to gather cards for that, and I said, I'm just going to go try it out, see what happens. So I made the four-hour drive that night, got a hotel. You know, it was nice to be kind of back home for me. Set up there, and before the show even technically opens to the public, I had $1,000 in sales. And right away I said, you know what, this could work. So it was a really good first show. I started doing a couple more in different areas and put my name out there. And by the time that Moeller show came around, I was a little bit more seasoned, had a great show there. And I come into December 2019 and I say, this is where I'm going. I'm going to take this as far as I can. And so far it's led me to this point.
Beautiful. So up to that point, the way you had acquired inventory was more from the mindset of a collector. Right. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right.
You were just buying stuff, and the stuff that you didn't want was making it to the table as a dealer.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly it.
That's it. Okay. So you're in that spot. You have a couple of good, you know, successful shows, and you think, okay, I got to go full time now because I can make this work. The first question that always comes to my mind is, okay, how are you going to get inventory? Like what does that look like? What were you thinking about then? How are you processing? Okay. How do I grow this and go full time? What do I got to go do to get cards?
Right. So at first it wasn't too much of a concern, because the idea was just I would bring my dollar boxes with me, and whatever was in those was in those. And I would just casually add more and more. I'd go through the boxes in my closet from opening wax, just do maybe a box a week and just take the stuff that was worth it, put it in those boxes. And then I would try to replace, if I sold something out of my showcase, I would try to replace it with another card at that show. So I'd take part of my profits, pocket it, and then take the rest and put it back into a card to replace it with. As time went on, I moved over to eBay to start selling there. And that's a little different, where you got to constantly have stuff coming into the store. So what happened after that was trying to buy out dollar boxes, trying to buy out quarter boxes. And I had a lot of success doing that in the early going, something that I still love to do to this day. I love getting those dollar and quarter boxes and getting great bargain finds. What really pushed me over the edge was doing consignments. So my philosophy for kind of looking through the dollar boxes is to look for the things that people don't have listed online. So if you want to go out and buy, you know, pick your favorite rookie from the last 5 years, you can find their cards easily. If you want to find maybe this tougher insert or parallel or something that's a very popular set to build, not as easy to go out and find that. And people maybe don't think it's worth the time to sell it, where I will take the time and I'll sell it. And I know that everybody watching this probably has cards somewhere where, I mean, you mentioned it, I don't know if it was before we started here or if it was while we were talking, but you said, you know, you're wife looks over at you and you got all the cards sitting over there, you know, you probably got some stuff too that's just, it's sitting there that you could turn into some cash. And
yep,
maybe it's not worth your time. That's the biggest thing I hear. And I tell people, you know what? It's worth my time. I'll take it off your hands for you for a commission. So doing those consignments, it helps me because I have no overhead into that inventory. All I have to do is have a place to store it. And I have that. And from there, I just, you know, get my little residual income off of each of those sales, which isn't much on an individual basis, but it adds up fairly quickly. And with that too, you know, that inventory, as I add more and more, you get larger orders. So all of a sudden, different consignees, their orders are mixing and matching their cards as well as my own. So it helps me move my own stuff. So that's really the biggest way that I grew things.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you made the shift and you started acquiring inventory by buying up lots and dollar boxes and quarter boxes and also supplementing it with consignment. I can only imagine the record keeping piece of that was something you had to nail down. And you say, it sounds like you're obsessive compulsive, like most card collectors are for the most part, right. But, were you taking then, are you still doing shows? Are you still traveling?
Yeah, it's more of a casual thing. Like once every couple of months I'll set up. It's great to just go out there. It's more so for, marketing, I guess, at this point now, because, you know, you can talk to people face to face, potentially get new clientele. And that's really what I try to use the shows for now.
Yeah, that makes sense then. Okay. So when you headed into it then and you said, okay, I'm in, I'm going full time. What were some of your original goals? Maybe not, you know, to get specific with financial numbers, but what kind of goals did you have going in to kind of check the box in your mind to say, okay, I made the right move. And do you feel like that actually happened early on?
At the beginning, it was just make $100 a day, because the way that I would, you know, if you expand that out, that's $36,500 a year, mm-hmm. which is, you know, that's better than some starting salaries for somebody straight out of college.
Yep.
And then as I grew it more and more, it was like, okay, let's do 150 a day, and let's mm-hmm. do 200. So every once in a while, if I feel like I'm, you know, if I hit that same number every single day for 30 days straight, then it's time to up my goal because it's becoming too easy at that point. So that's kind of the way that I would measure my growth. But in terms of actual like numbers after that, I just, you know, there's a lot of cards out there and a lot of potential out there. So I don't try to put myself into that box. You know, it's just kind of sky's the limit at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's 2 years. So you have a lot of historical data and learnings. If you were to put yourself back in that 2 year spot, you know, 2019, just starting, what are some of the things you maybe would have done a little differently now that you know what you know about the hobby? Yeah.
Well, number one, buy everything, because it all went up 6 months later. That would be
all right. That was a softball.
Yeah, that would be the easy choice. I think more so, and this is what I see a lot right now, is just build those relationships. And I think I did a pretty good job of that in the beginning. I wish I would have done more of that, like more of the networking, because there's a lot of people out there who sell cards. And especially in today, when there's a lot of the same cards that are being put out there, you have to do something to make yourself stand out. So either if you want to sell the same cards that everyone else has, what are you going to do to stand out? And having the lowest price can sometimes be really difficult. So you're going to have to do something else. So just being that familiar place, like people coming to you, knowing that they're going to get good service, knowing that you're going to treat them with respect, knowing that you take good care of your cards. You know, they're not going to get something that's damaged. They're not going to get scammed. They're not going to run into something down the line where all of a sudden, you know, you're canceling orders on them because, oh, this card is going up more, just this really short-sighted thinking. And I've seen that come back to bite people. So you have to avoid those types of things and just build those relationships, because they will take you much, you know, they'll help you progress in your goals more than one individual sale will.
Yeah. That, I think that that's probably the most underestimated thing that I see for sure, is the community is smaller than you think. First off, like if you do something stupid, like it's going to bite you really quick.
Yep.
But on the flip side, right, if you take care of people, like you said, the community, man, they're loyal. Like when you get a buyer, they are loyal. So I'm with you. I'm with
you. I mean, I'll tell you this story is that I had a Trevor Lawrence card the other day, and it was a high dollar card, and I sold it, but I did a background check on the buyer because I typically do that. And one of the things that came up when I searched this buyer's name was they were involved in a return on a Project 2020 card back during the boom of that, you know, almost 18 months ago now. And that came up and I saw it and I didn't do a deal with that person because of that. So some of these people think that, you know, maybe it will fall off after time. Well, sometimes it doesn't and it may cost you. So
that's just, well, look, I mean, from our perspective, we just shared our blocked bidders list with each other before we got on. Right.
Yeah. It's like,
from our side too, not only does as a buyer, right, when you do something stupid, like, you're not going to see cards from a lot of these sellers that just don't have the tolerance. And it's the same way on both sides of the.
Yep. 100%.
Yeah. So what does a typical day right now look like for you? Is it 8 hours of constant work, 12 hours of constant work? What it kind of walk us through what a day in the life of JT is.
It's going to be about 8 to 12 hours. So I have my own office space here now where I have the lower end cards kind of stored and I have all my shipping stuff, all my supplies set up. So I usually do a little bit of cycling. So what I do is I have these little Avery label sheets. So I use these, I put these on the back of the penny sleeves, and this is just a identifier. So I have like little SKU numbers. It helps pulling the cards a little bit easier. And if someone's coming in to help, like I have a few hired helpers, and if they come in, they can easily identify what the cards are. So you get 80 in one of these little sheets. So I will do about 80 cards, list them. Then I'll put together about 20 shipments, and then I'll just keep going back and forth. I'll check to see if I need to make a call or something, or do something else that's special. That's a pretty standard day. You know, so there's some times where things are special, like if there's a new release, and sometimes I'll do a case and then put those singles up. That's your longer, like 12 to 16 hour day. If it's like a PSA or SGC group submission, that's going to be a little bit of a longer day to do a reveal for that. But other than that, a lot of it is just putting cards up, sending cards out, getting new cards in, repeat.
Rinse and repeat. And I know early on, right, it's you kind of have to do it all. You don't have the choice because you're not hiring people to do things, you know, when you're just starting out. But as you look now, right, it's November 2021. What would you say are the tasks that you kind of value the most and that you always own for yourself and you kind of yourself into because it adds the most value to your business? Is there anything that sticks out?
I would say inventory acquisition is number one, because it's one of those things that's very difficult to teach. For example, going and pulling cards out of a box, especially with this now, because I use this because there are so many parallels where some of them look the same, and this has stopped me a couple of times even from doing that. That's something that you can teach. I can teach someone, you know, here's a standard envelope that's going out. I can teach someone how to do that. I can teach someone how I properly package my cards so that they don't get damaged. I can teach someone how to list a card if I really need to, and basically get it down to this formula that can be repeated. But it's really difficult to tell people exactly how to go out and buy inventory. I think a lot of people think, oh, it's easy. You didn't just go look at eBay comps. And then if it's lower than that, go out and buy it. But there's more to it. Just because something sells for that amount doesn't necessarily mean that I can get that amount for it. And if there's a lot of that out there, I need to be able to get it at a really good price so that I can give the next buyer a really good price as well. And just kind of thinking two steps ahead, what are the things that people actually want? What are people going to want to be able to buy out of my store? What is my store's, I guess, gimmick or specialty, if you will? What really fits that? And that's just something that you can't necessarily teach, or at least I haven't found a way to teach it yet.
Yeah, no, I hear you. You may have noticed I've done a couple of videos. I bought this large collection and I bought multiple collections, and I've kind of put out some tips and thoughts that I have. And I feel like that's the thing that is the hardest, right? Even if you tell someone this is how you do it, it's still so much kind of gained experience that goes into every purchase. And then communicating that to someone who's a novice and thinks and understands things differently than our worldview of the hobby, right? It's difficult. Right. It's a difficult task. When you look at collections, what do you kind of look for first, and kind of how do you approach the whole offer? Do you have a percentage in mind? Do you put a number to it and then say, I'm going to pay 65% of it? What's kind of your process when you're evaluating something?
So the first thing that I'm going to make sure is that the cards were taken care of. So one of the things I always check for is odor. If it's coming from a home of a smoker, unfortunately, a lot of the times that's going to add a process. One of my, if you guys are out there looking for tips, if I do get something in from someone who does smoke, what I'll use is I'll take a dryer sheet and I'll wrap the cards around it. I'll put them in like a 300 count box and I'll let it sit for a few days. And then I remove the dryer sheets. And usually that does a good job of getting rid of the odor. If there's smoke damage where the cards are yellowing, that's a different story. You can't really fix that. So that's one of the things. If it happens to be in an area where flooding is common, that's something you have to check for, is water damage and mold and that kind of stuff, because I have cards that are in good shape and I don't really want to contaminate those cards with maybe something else, or, you know, worst case scenario, send that to someone and it causes them some kind of health issues. That's, I want to make people happy, not have to deal with medical problems when they get cards from me in the mail. So that's one of the things I'm going to look for, how they take care of their cards. So are these cards in penny sleeves and top loaders? Are these cards just thrown into a shoebox? I'm sure we've all seen like the photos on Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist where it's like this Rubbermaid bin full of cards that are just, it looks like someone is playing 52,000 pickup with some junk wax era cards. That's something that I'm typically not really going to go through. On the other end of it too, is that if I always joke about this, is that people don't want to buy from me because I'm too organized. So if you come up to my show at a table, or my table at a show, you'll see that I have stuff sorted out by team in some of my boxes. All the stuff in the showcase is sorted out by sport. It's all labeled with the prices and everything. I'm too organized. That may be a sign that you're not going to find that deal in there, you know, because I know what I have. So that's also something I keep in mind too, is that people, you know, what are they pricing their stuff at? And even if I don't know the price of everything that's in there, if I know the price of a couple of things and I start to see a pattern, like, okay, they're consistently below market value at this place, that I know exactly where their head is at, and I can kind of use that to my advantage to negotiate.
I love it all. No, you obviously have thought through this, and yeah, you've done enough of these to know like there is a system that you can kind of add in with your theory and your knowledge to make it work for sure. So when you buy a collection, and we kind of talked about this offline a little bit, are you thinking about it in some cases as, I'm going to take these, I'm going to put them on, if they're $1, they're $5, it doesn't matter, I'm going to list these ungraded? Or is the thought now, I'm looking for cards immediately I know I can grade because you're evaluating condition, and I'm getting those off to PSA or SGC or whatever it may be? Combination of
right.
Both.
It is definitely a combination of both. I'm very careful with what I send in for grading because I never really want to be in that position where I get it back and it's worth as much as it was raw, or now it's worth even less than what I could have sold it for raw right away. And my idea with that too is that I don't need to milk every single dollar I can get out of every single purchase, because I've had people come to me and they've shown me cards they got off me that graded out as tens. And people say like, well, are you, you know, upset about that? You know, you could have had all this money. No, I'm not, because I know they're going to come back now because they know that they got these really clean cards from me, and that helps build my reputation. So yes, in the short term, I could have made more on an individual sale, but I've got a customer now who knows the quality that they're going to get from me. And they know that if there's some kind of issue with the card, I'm going to tell them to the best of my ability. And if I'm wrong or I miss something, I'm going to do my best to make it right to them as well. So a lot of times I'll only really grade it if I try to think, and it's definitely helped now with PSA's kind of slowdown over the past 6 months, and even more so in a year from now, do I want to have this stuff graded? And I sold a lot of Luis Robert cards that were pretty nice raw last year that a lot of people probably would have sent in. And if I was just getting them back now, they were not worth nearly as much as what I sold them for raw. So if those people want to take them, and you know, maybe I'm wrong and they go and get the profits out of them, good for them, because they'll probably be back.
Yeah, no, that's good. I remember talking to Brent Williams, Brent and Becca, about this many years ago. And then we rehashed it, I don't know, 6 months ago. And he'd always had that question from people. you know, because he, I mean, you're talking 60 to 100 cases of product. And it was kind of the same logic where, first off, he identified that was his niche and it was not going to be his niche to grade cards. And so you have to focus on what your niche is. And second, he's just like, look, if, yeah, of course you can point to these guys that have done well and grading would have made sense, but 90% of those guys didn't do well and I would have got crushed by it. So again, to your point, that takes a whole nother level of expertise that you probably have, but it, then it's like, okay, do I want to dedicate 8 hours of my week to qualifying cards out? And that's not your niche.
Absolutely. Right now. And that's one of the things too, I think, that a lot of people lose sight of, is that they see that end sale and what that number is, but there's shipping costs and fees that go into it. There's whatever price I had into the card as well. There's grading fees. There's also the value of my time. You know, this card is out of my possession for however long, sometimes even over a year. Yeah. At that point, it's kind of a sunk cost, or at least a lot of people would consider it that. So when I see something like that, it's something to really consider, is that, you know, your time is valuable and all these costs, you know, this end number might be this, but how much are you really making on those individual sales? And it's really easy to not look at that when you're on the other side of the table. But, you know, a lot of times when you see these cards at shows that are maybe overpriced in your opinion, or maybe they're going for more than what eBay says, a lot of these people have a lot of that stuff into it. And, you know, that's not your fault. You want to get the best price you can, but that's yep. A lot of times why people are doing that is because there is those overhead costs that you do have to consider.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. It's definitely the stuff that the novices don't really think about until they do it themselves. And they realize, oh my gosh, this is what a mess. What a mess. I've dealt with many guys that, you know, are trying to sell collections to me, and they pull up on their phone, you know, Joe Namath rookie, and then they see the PSA graded, you know, $15,000 price for a six or something. It's like, and this is coming from obviously a real example, and I try to explain to them, it's not that easy, right? Like, first off, vintage grading is so sneaking hard, and second, it's expensive to do this. And if you fail the first time, you're already losing money, right? You're already losing money.
Yeah.
It's just, you got to know what you're doing. But I know you do grade, right? And you grade with all the grading companies, but it sounds like you've been doing a lot of business with SGC. So tell me a little bit about that and kind of what made you decide to kind of shift some of your business over to SGC.
Right. The biggest knock that I hear about SGC has to do with the resale value. I think at this point in time, I hear very, very seldom do I have people who criticize their slabs, or I see them criticize their slabs. I don't really hear too much about the service complaints of that. And from my personal experiences, I've had no problems. It always comes back to the resale value. And this goes in line with what I said earlier, is that I don't need to get every single dollar that I can out of something. And I also don't like to put myself in a position where I need to get every single dollar that I can about something, because if it's coming down to that close, then that means I'm not buying at the correct price. My margins are way too small where I shouldn't be worrying about that. So grading with SGC, my strategy now is just kind of to have cards and slabs that I think I would feel more comfortable moving, because it reduces my risk of a return or some kind of complaint from the buyer. I think it's more visually appealing, the slabs. They do look professional. It does add to that. And people know exactly what they're getting. You know, I can give my opinion, and I like to think that my opinion is a good one, but you know what they say about opinions. So to get the opinion of someone who's a bit more trusted and established from a third party grader and using them as a conduit to sell my cards is huge. So I do really like the service that I've gotten from SGC. And I think that the more and more that their slabs are out there, the more exposure that they get and kind of get away from that reputation of them being the vintage grading company, it only helps the market to have that kind of competition. I don't like monopolies. I don't like this idea that you can only go one way, because that kind of overzealous thinking can really hurt people. It's almost a form of hobby gatekeeping, and we don't want that.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. It's tough because, yes, I love the slabs. I love the tuxedo approach. I think Peter, you know, the president of SGC has this unique idea, like, hey, I don't really care about the noise. I just want to be known as the most accurately graded grading company on the planet. I want people to know what they're getting in terms of grade is accurate, spot on. But it, all of it doesn't really matter if you get, you know, 20% of the resale value of a grade, two grades lower on a PSA, right? Like it's hard to sell the hobby on that. But I have been really impressed with how much they've come around this year. You know, I mentioned to you offline, their market share on eBay is up like 4%. It's up to 7% of the market share in graded cards. And their resale values, you probably noticed this too, have really shrunk. The gap is closed considerably. Vintage, it's almost even with PSA for similar grades. It's like literally almost even. And in modern cards, obviously, it's going to take a bit, but I'm impressed. I think you had some big cards recently graded with one of your subs, right? You maybe put it on, did you put it on Instagram or somewhere? But
it's on the channel right now. Yeah, okay. We had a customer who submitted some really nice Tom Brady cards. There was a, I think it was 2008, I want to say, Leaf Limited Spotlight Platinum, which was a 1-of-1. There was another one that was a gold out of 10. There was a dual autograph with Peyton Manning out of 10. And I did speak with him last night, and apparently he is going to be selling at least the Peyton Manning Brady dual autograph. And I originally thought they were going to be in his collection, but it seems like he is going to look to move them. And I think the more exposure that people get will definitely – if you get used to seeing those big cards in the SGC holders, and we've talked about this before too, privately, it only can help them. And as a buyer too, you know, you don't want to subject yourself to buying something in a slab just because it's in a slab and getting something that's not quality. But I think if you expand your horizons to more grading companies, it only helps yourself because it only presents more opportunities to get the cards you want. It may not necessarily be in the holder that you're used to, but you still end up with the card that you want. And SGC is well established. It didn't just come around in the last few years. They've been around for decades now. You're getting a quality service still. And you know, this extends to BGS, to PSA, to the companies that have been very well established for a long period of time. The more that you're able to open yourself up to the different opportunities or even buying the cards just raw, the more opportunities you give yourself as a buyer to get the cards you want and build the collection that you want. So it's definitely encouraging to see more people are, it, based on what you said, I mean, that shows that the engagement on SGC slabs has doubled in terms of actually shelling out for money. And personally, I've seen a lot more of them at shows. I've seen a lot more of them listed for sale. It's just healthy for the hobby overall.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think a lot of things you mentioned just about the way they run their company, the way they focus on customer support, like that starts to really impact the way people view SGC, and it's starting to really make a difference, which is great. You're not only buying in terms of like your card increasing in value, but when the SGC slabs increase in value as a whole, it helps the value of your card, right? It's kind of a, you're doubling down in a couple ways.
Right.
Kind of a fun thing to do. Well, and to your point too, I think it's a good transition in terms of platforms, right? When you start to grade your cards, you're protected in the sense that you have no arguments from buyers about the condition, but you also can sell on other platforms. And I think you sell MySlabs and maybe some other places too, right? Have you diversified your business in that way?
Yeah, it's definitely something where eBay is still the gold standard for selling cards, but you will see a lot of people now use social media platforms. I get reached out to on Instagram fairly often now, which is a platform that I haven't really utilized to the best of my ability, I would say. But I'm seeing more things. I've heard a lot of talk about Whatnot, and I know there's some pretty prominent people in the hobby using Whatnot now. You have these companies like MySlabs, and especially with the graded cards, I think a lot more websites are being opened devoted to the graded cards just because there's less risk involved. Generally speaking, you're going to see less risk for returns or disputes over cards that are graded because the number one dispute that you're going to get with trading cards is condition, is people arguing over the condition. So when you have that kind of third party to step in and say, this is what it is, it eliminates a lot of that. Now you're not going to reduce your risk 100%, but it definitely, I think that's why a lot of these platforms are very popular, and especially with the prevalence of slabs and how popular slabs have become, it's become a very good alternative, which again, having those alternatives, having those options is healthy for a market as both a buyer and a seller.
For sure. No, very well said. Is it just my slab? So you don't do Whatnot or Instagram a little bit, but have you decided to jump into Whatnot?
I'm looking into it. Okay. It's something where, you know, you hear about something new and you kind of just want to get that exposure to new things and just kind of learn more and more about it. And I think as time goes on, I'll probably expand myself more and more, but there are a lot of platforms out there now to, you know, we're focusing more so on selling here, but as a buyer, utilize those platforms. I actually just bought a card off of Mercari last night. It was a Tom Brady card. You know, you'll be a fan of that there. And I got it for half the price of what you get it for on eBay. And that's just another platform that you could use. So those tools are out there. If you know where to look, you can get some really good deals and really build a collection for a lot cheaper, which I think is the goal of ultimately every collector, is to spend less and get more.
Yeah, no, that's good. Back to eBay. And I know everyone watching this probably sells or buys to some degree on eBay. Like you said, they're the gold standard. What would you say have been the lessons learned about building your brand on eBay? What are the things that you can coach people to do better? What would it be to building that kind of brand and awareness on eBay?
I would say the thing that's helped me the most is what I like as a collector is not what everyone else likes, but having that mindset of a collector and just that natural instinct, I think gives you a huge advantage over someone who's not a collector, who may be only in it for monetary reasons, which there's nothing wrong with that. But I think in order to sell a product well, and this goes for anything, you really have to believe in that product. I was in a sales job out of college where I did not believe in the product, and it was extremely difficult to make sales to not have that confidence in it. I mean, I was told what to say and everything, but being able to have your products and stand by them is huge. So when you open up your eBay account or you're using your eBay account to sell, you know, you want to make sure that you have clean images, because I know that when I'm scrolling through looking for a Miguel Cabrera card for my collection, I'm not looking at the title, I'm looking at the image, because a lot of times things are mistitled. Things aren't, maybe the title isn't descriptive enough. So I'm going to look at that image first. So make sure that your photographs are clean or your scans are clean. Make sure that your titles give good search engine optimization. You know, think about what do you search for when you go to buy a card, and that's what your title should be. I usually put team names on there too, because the bulk orders I get a lot of times are from the same team. So I'll put Lakers or Red Sox at the end of my title, and then that helps people easily search out those specific teams. You know, getting your brands right, your parallels right, that will help you not only in making sure the buyers get what they want, but exposing your listings to more buyers. And the more exposure that you get, the more opportunities that you get. I would really advise against the search engine. You know, you want to optimize, but don't exploit it. Don't put PSA 10 if it's not graded by PSA and it's not a 10, because you're going to turn people off from your listings. There have been cards that I've been wanting to buy that I just passed on because they put that in the title, and I just am not going to support that. And, you know, maybe that's not the mentality for everyone, like I said, but you don't want to give people reasons not to buy from you. You want to make sure it's professional. You want to make sure that people are getting what they paid for. And ultimately you want to build a brand that drives repeat customers. So eBay has a send coupon feature that's relatively new. It wasn't there when I first started. Utilize that. Do promotions in your store, because eBay will advertise it for you. They will go to bat for you, because the more sales you make, the more sales and revenue they generate as well. So you're kind of this mutualistic, I guess, relationship where you're benefiting each other. You know, this isn't a parasitic thing where eBay takes everything from you. If you know how to work it, you can really optimize yourself. So, you know, be organized, be professional, and really think in terms of what do you want to see as a buyer, and then put that out there for your buyers. I think it will help you tremendously.
Symbiotic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while.
Yeah. It's been a while. I'm not a science guy either, so I couldn't even tell that for you. those are great tips. Those are outstanding tips. You're heading into 2022. What are your goals and how excited are you about your business heading into the new year? I should have probably asked this at the beginning. I'm assuming you're going to continue this.
Right. All right. I have my office and I'm at the start of a new lease now. So we're only just starting. I'm hiring people to come on and do the tasks that maybe I can turn into something that's more formulaic or it can be repeated. And it's stuff that I don't necessarily have to do anymore. So I can do the things that I'm best at, but just continuing to grow the business, you know, continuing to get those customers and repeat customers ideally, and just continue to grow the brand, because I, you know, it's very euphoric for me to see sales go up, not just because it means I'm generating more income for myself, but also just see myself moving more product and see that growth is a very fulfilling thing. So growth is the name of the game, as it always has been, but no specific goals, and just, you know, keep adding to this formula that it had since the beginning.
Yeah. You mentioned that twice now about hiring, I'm assuming part-time workers to do the stuff that you've already helped automate and laid out for us.
Yep.
Yeah. What does it cost to hire someone these days? $15, $10 an hour. Do you pay them by a percentage?
Yeah. Usually it's about $15 an hour plus incentives. Yeah. I'm someone who does. Yeah. I believe very much so that I don't want to have someone just come in where they know exactly what they're getting. Like you are going to know what you're going to get. So you're going to get that base pay and that's your security blanket. But if you do really well, you know, if you help me do well, I'm going to share that with you because I value your time. And if you're valuing my time and driving up my sales and allowing me to do the things that make me more money, I'm going to value that. And you're going to get more of the share too. So that's just kind of my mentality with it, is that it's very incentive driven as well. But I do believe in having that base salary to kind of give people, you got to have some kind of security. You don't want to be paid $2 an hour and then all commission from there. It's it's a little bit of a roll of the dice, and you don't know what to expect at that point.
Heck yeah. You sound like a great owner, a great boss. Everybody wants to work for a guy like that.
Hey, we're taking your applications. Leave them in the comments down below.
There you go. You can apply to be a grader at PSA, or you can apply to go help run a business with JT. Transactionally, we don't have to talk about revenue, but from, you know, hundreds a day, probably tens a day when you started, to what are you aiming for? Thousands of transactions a day?
A 1,000 transactions a week is a good week for me. Wow. Because at the very minimum, if you look at the average sale of my cards, it's about, $4 each. So that's $4,000 a week. And if you repeat that, that's over $200,000 a year. So I think most people would be happy with that. And it doesn't always get to that point, but to constantly flow things in, just to see that things are flowing and that things are coming in and things are coming out and people are actually engaging with the products is what's really important to me. And if I see the same names popping up in my order list, that's also what's extremely important to me. So I'll take a day where maybe it's a little bit slower in terms of the number of transactions if I'm just making what I would call quality sales. People who are buying multiple cards, where it's even more worth my time to make sure that they're satisfied. You know, I want to make sure everyone's satisfied too, but you know, driving those sales to get those really loyal customers that are going to be what keeps food on the table at the end of the day. And ultimately, you know, what helps build your brand as well.
No, that's great. I'll just add to that. There's no scientific evidence or, written evidence to back this up, but I do feel like eBay rewards consistency with the way things show up in the algorithms and the way things, convert. I feel like when I go weeks where I'm listing 20 to 50 things a day and I'm shipping within 24 hours, I feel like it snowballs really quickly to the positive. And I don't know if eBay's propping you up because of that, rewarding you, or if it's just, you know, the natural progression, but it sure feels like eBay rewards the people that treat their customers and their business right.
It would make sense to me, just because eBay, they don't want to deal with disputes and returns as much as we don't want to, because it just costs them money and costs them their time as well. they have a very good business model in terms of they don't have to do that much work other than host a platform and just kind of do some housekeeping stuff on their end. And then you pretty much do the work for them with generating your sales. And then they take a cut for you to basically use their brand to make your sales and build your store. So when I've talked to eBay reps, they understand that a store of my size at this point, not to, to toot my own horn or anything, but yeah, we have a really good relationship. We're very dependent on each other, and they know that I will generate a lot of revenue for them. So they're going to, you know, they appreciate that, and they appreciate that I don't cause them a lot of problems. Yeah. Very low maintenance, and they get a lot of money for a little work with me. So they appreciate that.
For sure. For sure. I think we do forget that. I know the hobby thinks that it's so much oriented towards the buyer, and it is. eBay still needs to shift that pendulum a little bit further to the seller side, I think, but
They're
getting better at taking care of sellers. I think they're figuring out they need to do that. So it's good to hear it's working for you.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, you've got a great story, and you've obviously worked your tail off to get where you are, and you're doing outstanding, it sounds like. And I recommend anyone watching this that has consignments that they want to get into JT's hands, I'll put your information below, but tell people how they can get a hold of you. And before we let you go, we're going to do some rapid fire here in a second, but how can people find you and work with you? You're hearing this.
The name below is the name that I use on all platforms, except for here on YouTube. Triple Crown 24 is a YouTube channel, but that's the worst way to get in contact with me. You can shoot me an email to my personal email, JTGRUGEN, my first and last name at gmail.com. We can get in touch through there. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. You can also get in touch with me through eBay, and we can get in touch there. And that's pretty much where you can go from it. And my eBay store is what you see down below. Try to have a little bit of something for everyone. So try to cover all sports, try to cover all budgets. Average price of a car to my store is $2.60. So that tells you there's something for every single budget available there.
There you go. You got the metrics down, man. You're just firing them off.
I've done that once or twice.
I think that's probably a more convincing sales pitch than anything, right? You know your business, and people that do business with you are going to get something that's pretty well defined. I'll put all those links in the show notes, guys. You don't have to try to remember all that, and you can find JT that way. All right, so let's close with some rapid fire. I love to do this stuff. What's your favorite background band to have while you're sorting and doing your work?
Oh man, I'm going to get exposed here. I'm so basic. I love to put on just top 40 radio, man. I all these people have all these really cool, interesting things. I'm pretty basic. So
weak. Couldn't even give me a band. All right. What's your guilty pleasure movie? The movie that, like, if you're going to sit down, you're like, I could watch this thing anytime.
Ooh. I would say basically any Disney movie, and I'm not like a huge like animation fan or anything, but I'm more so a geek where Disney, they're just a machine where they can just, you know, plop out a new story every 6 months that follows the same formula, and it's massively successful. So I just like look at that and how like great the storytelling is and how intricate it is, and look at all these geeky things, like, dang, they're just so good.
What's your favorite Disney movie? You got to pick one right now. What is it?
Ooh, probably have to go with Finding Nemo. It's a classic. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. If you could go back and be a seed investor for any of the new startups in the hobby, so startups like Loop or Starstock or Collectible, any of those names, like which one would you be a seed investor in?
There's a lot of really good choices out there. Probably have to go with Card Ladder just because I see them used the most. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great tool. There's a lot of tools out there that are similar, but it seems to be the most widely used. And from my own experience, I really do like their platform. It seems like it's maybe the most user-friendly interface out there. So I would love to get into that. Maybe it's just my own bias with how much I've enjoyed it. But
okay, I dig it. Which cartoon character best represents JT?
Oh, geez. So there used to be a joke in college that I looked like Johnny Bravo because my hair would get really staticky and stand straight up. As you can see, I'm pretty ripped. But
it's barely
I wear like, Yeah, I wear like black t-shirts very often too. So aside from the blonde hair, and I wear sunglasses a lot. So only for physical appearance, I'll have to go with Johnny Bravo.
I love it. I love it. Favorite sports book or movie?
Ooh. I'll have to go with Caddyshack, which I don't know how much of a sports movie it is. It's golf themed, so I'll go with that. But I used to be a golf caddy. And there's a lot of truths to that movie. You know, there's a lot of there's a lot of things that are very relatable, and I've probably seen it more times than I can count at this point. So I'll go Caddyshack.
There's your guilty pleasure movie right there.
Yeah.
All right. So I want you to be as specific as you can on this. Give you $10,000. You have to spend it today in the hobby, and it cannot be on Miguel Cabrera. What do you spend it on?
That's tough. Well, about Miguel Cabrera, that makes it really hard. Since I would have to spend it all today for the time's sake, I'm probably going with the GOATs or the modern day GOATs. So I'm talking about your guys like Curry, LeBron, Tom Brady, Rodgers. And the reason I picked those guys is because I feel like one of the mindsets now is that people – FOMO is such a big thing, and people want to make sure, and things are almost priced at the point now where it's almost where people are like, there's no room to even like get in anymore because everything is priced with FOMO completely eliminated from it. You know, you have to pay these extraordinary amounts to even get into things, but the best deals aren't necessarily always whatever the cheapest thing is. And the most undervalued cards aren't necessarily what the cheapest cards are right now. There's a lot of cards out there that are going to cost you a pretty penny to get involved in. But overall, if you're looking to spend your hobby dollars the right way, whether you're a collector who just wants to get the best bang for your buck, or you're someone who does this for, you know, monetary purposes where you want to make money on this in the future, you don't necessarily have to get the next big prospect and make it big on them. You can get the safe bet, and it's not as sexy sometimes as maybe some of the flashy young guys. But if you get the right cards at the right prices and you get them in good condition, you can do very well. And just because it's not the huge, you know, in terms of percentage, you know, you're not going to have these 10,000% profits on these cards in terms of what they go up to in their value. But you may double your money on it. You may get it for half the price that it will be tomorrow. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm looking for. And that, again, that ties back to what I said. I'm not always out to make the most I can. I just, as long as I come out ahead and I get something that's safe that I know will work, I'll take that any day of the week over rolling the dice.
Mic drop. It's a great way to end. Boom. JT, it's been awesome. Thanks so much for joining us today. Have yourself an amazing Thanksgiving.